passion, not just our business.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Welcome to the real world.
The Matrix slipped onto the big screen in 1999 as a thoughtful meditation on the nature of reality that captured digital age anxieties about man and machine. With a sleek techno look and slickly choreographed violence, the sleeper film grossed more than $450 million worldwide and spawned two more films. Tepid reviews for The Matrix Reloaded sequel didn't hurt its box office take, which surpassed the original. This week, the third and ostensibly final installation, The Matrix Revolutions, landed in 18,000 theaters worldwide, the biggest film rollout ever. That does not make it a great film, but it does make us wonder at the endless human and Hollywood fascination with the interaction of man and machine. Tonight on Point, from Frankenstein to The Matrix, screen heroes wrestle with the nature of reality and what humankind has wrought. Joining me in the studio tonight is On Point movie maven Garen Daly, artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater. Great to have you, Garen.
Hi, Tom.
And joining us from San Francisco is Alexander Cohen, lecturer for the program in film studies at UC Berkeley and co-founder and executive director of undergroundfilm.org, a website for the independent film distribution world. Good evening and welcome, Alexander Cohen.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. Let's listen, just to get ourselves back into the mind of The Matrix, to a clip from the old original, The Matrix, 1999.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room.
You can see it when you look out your window, or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work,
when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch.
The Matrix, 99, and two more came. They're playing this week. If you didn't see the original, you'll have trouble with the third one, which is out right now. But, Garen, take us back into this film. Where did this film come from, and what's the story that got all of its fans so excited?
Well, the film came from these two brothers, Larry and Andy Wachowski, who actually storyboarded a comic book that was in their head, and they did a wonderful job. And what they did was they took a pastiche of Hong Kong action films, some very pop psychology things, and they kind of intermingled that in a wonderful science fiction story about a world, a universe in the future where the machines dominate everybody and the human beings are nothing more than energy sources to be farmed. And to keep the humans in a quiescent state, they've created images in their minds like their brains in a vat, and that's all they are, creating energy for the machines. The movie starts off with a band of rebel human beings who find Neo, which is an anagram for one, who is the one person who will helpfully get them out of bondage and release their human being soul.
Their inner potential, the reality. And, of course, the lasting image from that film is of this enormous field or catacomb filled with kind of comatose pods of human beings who are, in a sense, living in a kind of video game, in a programmed reality, while they're, in fact, asleep. Alexander Cohen, do you remember when you first saw this, the response of the audiences around you, your own response?
Well, it was definitely one of sort of awe. You know, I mean, it was a beautiful moment. I think it's the really defining moment of that film. It's certainly the moment when people understand the power of the visual effects and the whole concept of, awakening from a different reality.
So is this, Alexander Cohen, to your mind, foremost, a movie about humans wrestling with technology, or is it the age-old question that Plato raised, I guess, about what is reality?
I think it's sort of in between. I think that the brothers really, in some sense, didn't really decide it's going to be one or the other. So I think it's really both, and it sometimes gets a little muddled, I think, for that reason as well.
Garen, we're going to look at the story and the sequels and the whole legacy of film that kind of led up to this Matrix moment and many other moments in sci-fi as well. But just as a business proposition, this has been something else. I mean, they never planned this huge success, this huge rollout today. A reported 18,000 theaters this is in. Wow.
This is a record. I mean, and it's looking at it from the outside and looking at the industry, you have to say 18,000 prints internationally. They're even in China, which is a first. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them obviously is that they're terrified that once this film plays in a couple of theaters, that somebody in Hong Kong is going to get a DVD out and saturate the market. So they're trying to beat that off. You also have to question whether or not Time Warner, which has just dropped the AOL, really needs to have a major success. They have spent $100 million just on marketing this film. They reportedly spent $200 million on making the film. So this film has got to gross for them to break even just in the economics of the business around $600 million to break even, and it probably will.
Now, it does not mean it's a great film, but it sure is out there and everywhere. It's a kind of a thunderclap release. They hope to get a huge number of people in to see it right away.
Yeah, they're going to try and get everyone to see it right away. The wonderful parts that were in the original Matrix, that original storyboard film was wonderful, and you have to say to yourself, it looked like the Wachowski brothers got themselves way in over their head.
But the initial idea was so captivating, and Alexander Cohen, I wonder if you see this in other film sequences as well, that people can just get hooked on a core idea. In this case, the core idea of what's reality, what's fantasy, is it possible we're living in kind of a giant video game? In a game when, in an era when supercomputers and all the rest are everywhere, I suppose that's a very current kind of fascination, even fear.
The audience that this film is really aimed for is a video game audience. You know, and in many ways, the inspiration, both visually, graphically, the very sequences that everyone remembers, bullet time and so on, are all very much video game inspired.
Bullet time, so you're talking with that very balletic kind of slow-mo violence here where bullets fly and spin and the characters, the actors sort of fly around them in slow motion.
Well, that's right, but also the question of where the player fits within the game. In other words, when a game player actually is playing in a game, he becomes that character, and he takes on the qualities and the powers of that character as well. And that's exactly what Neo does. Neo jacks in, and then he becomes as powerful. Once he learns how to do that, he becomes as powerful as, he becomes all-powerful in the game itself.
Okay, Garen, you're going to have to keep us in the game in this conversation. Not everyone will have seen this. Jacks in. Help us with that.
Well, what that is that in your real reality, in the human reality in the movie, you are in a spaceship in this very dark world. You jack in with a portal in your back of your neck, and you literally put a plug in there, and you go into the Matrix, which is the world as we know it, with the skyscrapers and the sun setting and people walking around in the streets and the like. However, one of the things that is important about the film and its initial acceptance by everybody is the philosophy that runs through it. And in the movie, they have adopted a lot of the Greek and ancient myths, and they created an oracle, somebody who knows what's going to happen. And Neo, as the one, has to go to that person and find out what their role is, what their quest is.
And remind us of the point of Neo, the savior, the one. What's he supposed to accomplish? Is he going to break all these humans out of their pods and back into electronic reality?
He's supposed to bring everyone back to their true human nature. And when he goes to the Oracle, she is the one that is going to tell him what he needs to do.
This is in Matrix Reloaded. Here Neo talks with the Oracle.
We're all here to do what we're all here to do. I'm interested in one thing, Neo, the future. And believe me, I know the only way to get there is together.
Are there other programs like you?
Oh, well, not like me, but look, see those birds? At some point, a program was written to govern them. A program was written to watch over the trees and the winds, sunrise and sunset. There are programs running all over the place. The ones doing their job, doing what they were meant to do, are invisible. You'd never even know they were here. But the other ones, every story you've ever heard about vampires, werewolves, or aliens is the system assimilating some program that's doing something they're not supposed to be doing.
Someone doing something they're not supposed to be doing. What amazing characters were first introduced here, however they were ultimately developed. There's the moment in the first film when Lawrence Fishburne is Morpheus,
I don't remember the exact dialogue, but he confronts Neo with a red pill and a blue pill.
That's right.
And he says, you take the blue pill, the story ends, you wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. In other words, you're still hooked up, you're still part of the fantasy. You take the red pill, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Alexander Cohen, do you think that viewers around the world feel that close to that question of fantasy and reality, of what's real and what's not, that it's hooked them in that easily?
Well, I think it's actually a metaphor for, you know, our state in a couple of different ways. Number one, our relationship to the powers that be, capitalism, global economies and so on. So I think that's one aspect of where they people sort of understand it. The other way, of course, is religion itself, where religion and the fact that there could be some power outside of us that controls us or otherwise determines our fate. I think that both those things allow the people to sort of see a relationship between that and what happens with Neo.
And Garen, what's the tension? What's the conflict that goes on through each of these three films? What are the rebels, I guess, in this underground Zion who are fighting back against the Matrix? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, obviously, the machines want to keep the status quo, which, again, exactly what Alex was talking about. It's like, is there an all-powerful global economy running things? And in the Matrix, yes, it is. It's the machines. They want to continue to do what they're doing. The rebels, obviously, are in opposition to that. So the tension exists because the machines are trying to keep the rebels and the humans under control. There is a city buried deep underground called Zion, which they want to attack and destroy. Neo stands in the way. And every time that Neo is confronting the Matrix, he's confronting it through an Agent Smith, which turns out to be sort of like its opposite. So there's a positive and a negative force going on.
Neo is also Agent Smith?
Or? No, he's not. Not that he's Agent Smith, but at the end of the original Matrix, Neo runs through Agent Smith, who is a program, and the interaction between the two make them sort of like, you know, a yin and yang, with Neo being the good one and Agent Smith being the bad one, who accrues more power. And in Matrix Revolutions, it's all about Agent Smith accruing more and more power that in himself starts to question and challenge the machine.
Yeah, so one thing I think that comes up, and it was sort of in that piece you just played for us, was the notion that these viruses or these programs become rogue programs, and in that sense, they also become sentient, and they also become essentially artificial life forms within the Matrix itself. Unlike Neo and other characters who have an actual body, an actual, you know, physical existence, apparently a physical existence, these rogue programs are the ones that actually are artificial life forms developed inside the Matrix. It's inside the Matrix itself.
So
its
technology
software,
kind of morphing off of itself. Let's listen to a little bit of the latest, The Matrix Revolution.
Everything that has a beginning has an end. I see the end coming. I see death. And you are all that stands in his way.
Smith.
Very soon, he's going to have the power to destroy this world, but I believe he won't stop there. He can't. He won't stop until there's nothing left at all.
What is he?
He is you. Your opposite, your negative. The result of the equation trying to balance itself out. This war is going to end. Tonight, the future of both worlds will be in your hands. Or in his.
The Oracle speaks. You know, Garen Daly, we had just a couple of weeks ago on the show Bill Joy, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems. And he had a big piece in Wired magazine a couple of years ago quoting, and I don't remember who wrote it, but quoting a tech philosopher at some length looking forward to a future where computers really do dominate activity on the planet, and that human beings become a burden rather than something useful. In that scenario, they weren't turned into a power plant, batteries for the computers, but saying, hey, you know what, there could come a time when they don't really need human beings. They're wasteful. They'll want to get rid of them. With that kind of thing in the popular culture, in the air, it's not so hard to imagine the appeal of this hook.
Well, you know, I think that what we need to do is I agree with that. I think that it's a fear that we have right now that the machines are going to take over. But, you know, in popular culture, we have always looked at trying to figure out what our fears are and how they're going to manifest themselves. We can go back to early film time and we can talk about, you know, films like, you know, Trip to the Moon by the Méliès at the turn of the century. We can talk about the first Frankenstein. We can talk about the Frankenstein in 1931, where electricity is the issue and the creation of, you know, human beings and man playing with science and dabbling in things that we shouldn't do, that it's somehow going to destroy us.
We'll do that. Let's take a break. We'll go back and look at Frankenstein and a lot more that came well before The Matrix. I'm joined tonight by Garen Daly, our on-point movie maven, and from Berkeley, California, Alexander Cohen, lecturer for the program in film studies at UC Berkeley. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the interaction of man and machine on the big screen, about screen heroes wrestling with the nature of reality and what humankind has wrought. The third in the Matrix trilogy is out this week. You may or may not be a Matrix fan, but there's a long, long film history in looking at technology and the future and how human beings interact with it. Our movie maven Garen Daly is with us tonight, and also joining us tonight from Berkeley, California, is Alexander Cohen, lecturer in the program in film studies at UC Berkeley. Garen, you were just talking about Frankenstein, the old original. Let's listen just a little clip from the 1931 Frankenstein.
It's moving. It's alive. It's alive. It's moving. It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. Oh, in the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
Oh my, that sounds like an moment. It's alive, it's alive. What electricity and what had been dead flesh brought to life here, technology and human beings literally brought together.
But what we fear here is we fear that man is acting as God. We're coming out of that early post-industrial period, and people are afraid. Where is science going to take us? Will they be playing God? And that is a question that we were dealing with then, and we're still dealing with in some ways right now.
So throughout, films have the capacity with special effects and imagination to bring to the screen an image of those fears, you say, that technology has kind of created throughout. I want to welcome into our conversation Andrew O'Hare. He's arts and film editor for Salon.com. He joins us from New York. Good evening and welcome, Andrew O'Hare.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Andrew O'Hare, you've seen the Matrix films. I wonder where you put these films in this kind of long chain of films where Hollywood movie makers and the society at large wrestle with technology and its implications.
Well, I think that they're very important in that history, particularly the first Matrix of 1999, which strikes me as a groundbreaking film that really captured the essence of its moment in some ways. And, you know, film is kind of a dream state for our culture. And, not to be a sort of literal-minded Freudian about it, but the desires and fears that are preoccupying us tend to show up on the screen. And I think that as you guys have been talking about over the course of the last century, technology has been one of the most consistent themes, and it is a dialectic. It is both desire and fear that come into it, and I think the Matrix movies speak to both of those things.
So what was the new step or the new fear that you've seen played out in the Matrix?
Well, to the extent that it was accessing a tradition in philosophy, which is both ancient and even postmodern, the idea that what we think is the real world isn't, and that by creating industrial civilization, we have lost something essential, both about our own nature and about our connection to the so-called real world.
And what do you make of the fact that almost everyone agrees that they haven't entirely sustained this idea? Is it just impossible to sustain? What happened with the brothers here?
I actually think a number of factors come into play. I do think that the brothers Wachowski ultimately bit off more than they can chew. I'm one of relatively few critics who actually liked the second movie pretty well. I think that they were able to actually go to a new level of complexity in that second film. What they couldn't do, however, was capture a moment. The Matrix in 1999 had a lot to do with the technology boom and people's anxieties about that. It might seem counterintuitive that was almost the apex of the big dot-com boom, and it's an ostensibly anti-technological film. But I think that was really crucial to its success, actually, because the question of are our lives dominated by technology and what does that mean was really first and foremost on the sort of social, cultural, psychological agenda.
So as the boom went by, that was slightly less central. Garen, what themes dominate then the second and third films?
Well, the second film, in my opinion, is more of an action film. It really just, you know, they take some of the tension that was there and just expounded on it and made it a very good action film. Sort of like what James Cameron did when there was Alien and he did Aliens. Mm-hmm. Aliens is a little stronger thematically, but it was still basically a wonderful action film. The problem with the third film was they didn't know how to end it. So you had your first act, which is, you know, the beginning, which is Matrix. Matrix Reloaded was your second act. The third act just doesn't quite gel together. And I think just like we were talking about, they bit off more than they can chew, and they kind of bought into the Hollywood mystique, and they just ground it out, and they didn't really wait to create all the necessary philosophies to make it a coherent story.
Alexander Cohen, do you buy that view?
Pretty much. I think the last I just saw the most recent one last night, and what was clear to me was that they didn't get it. They really couldn't go far enough with the original concept of this sort of secondary reality, and they didn't know what to do with the relationship between the machines and the Matrix in that sense of the real lives of the people, the machines themselves, and how. You know, how that itself might have been potentially a yet another layer of unreality. So I think it's sort of – I was expecting them to do that, and they didn't do it. And I think it was unfortunate that they couldn't really go beyond what they had done before.
But it is remarkable to see how film by film in this vein, Hollywood has struggled to figure out all the implications of technology's arrival and its integration and all the fears that it brings with us. Garen, take us to a new one here, 1953.
Well, in 1953, George Pal took H.G. Wells' classic story, War of the Worlds, and adapted it for America and for the American audience in the post-World War II, you know, the brand new atomic age.
Now, this was an old story, though. 98, H.G. Wells had written it.
Yes, but he adapted it for America, and he adapted it to what our fears were at that time. And that at that point, in 1953, the Russians just got the bomb. We were afraid of nuclear war. We were afraid of communism. We were afraid of being attacked. And here we have H.G. Wells. And then think about it. You know, he has the military in control of the atomic bomb as our technology of saving people. And in the film, you get the generals, the Pentagon, getting together, figuring out they've got the best solution to solve this problem.
There's only one thing that'll stop the Martians. We've held back because of the danger of radiation to civilians. Now there's no choice. The White House will confirm an order to use the atom bomb.
And our first target will be the initial landing place outside Los Angeles.
First thing you get there, arrange for the Pacific Tech scientist to monitor the drop. I'll send wire orders ahead of you and have the area clear all around. We've still time to hit them before dark. And we'll blast them all over the world.
H.G. Wells did not have an atom bomb in his book in 1898, but there it was, going to hit the Martians and their technology with humans' best or worst.
Yeah, and you know what? It's classic Hollywood. They took a well-known title, they had an author they didn't have to pay any royalty fees to, and they created a technological film that really did very well at the box office. And one of the other things, is that the films themselves have a certain amount of technology that has to be done. When we're talking about The Matrix, they, even though I agree with what we've been talking about in terms of it being technology as being a fear for The Matrix, but it's also technology within the film itself, the actual making of the film that makes the film accessible to a lot of the people in the audience. They need to be titillated that way.
Andrew O'Hare, I wonder if you have any ideas on what is it about this genre of film that makes it so open to the sequel, the sequel, the sequel? I mean, with Alien, with Star Wars, Star Trek, Matrix, why does this brand of film tend to come out again and again?
I don't know that there's an easy answer to that question. I do think that over the course of the last 30 years, Hollywood has discovered the fantasy film and the science fiction film is the key to the young audience, especially the young male audience that they've been so hypnotized by ever since the release of Star Wars. And it's, once you've got a franchise, you don't want to let go of it. I don't honestly believe that there's anything thematically central to the question of why there are so many sequels. I mean, once you have a fan base, they want more.
Except that I wonder if these particular fascinations with the implications of technology, the human interaction with it, they don't go away. I mean, technology goes on, the interest goes on. If you find a good hook, you can use it and use it. Alexander Cohen, I hear you there.
Yeah, well, I might add, though, that in a certain sense, the technological films, which are very much about the technology of filmmaking itself, sort of wants, to, in a certain sense, wants to replicate itself. So that the sequel is really a replication, right, of the last machine, in that sense, being the last film. So I think that filmmaking in general has rested with this question of artificial life, artificial intelligence, and the relationship between, you know, man and machine, and how that relationship will work out. I was going to mention that way back in with Samuel Butler around the turn of the century, 1800s, he wrote about man being potentially a machine tickling aphid, and that was taken on later by Marshall McLuhan and other people.
A machine tickling aphid.
Right, which I think is a wonderful expression that's been, you know, it sort of became, I think, one of the issues for how filmmakers think about the relationship of technology to humankind.
In other words, that humans were not the center of the universe, but rather just sort of playing around in a world of machines, that notion.
That's right. And he also mentions in this wonderful passage called Book of the Machines that that machines utilize humans as their proxy sexual organs, like insects, like flowers use insects.
You never know what you may be to a Martian. Garen, take us on here. 1956, The Body Snatchers come on the scene.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite films, and I remember seeing this as a child late one night and being absolutely terrified of it, because this is a film directed by Don Siegel, starring Kevin McCarthy and Dana Winter. It's in the 50s, and again, it has that same kind of 50s fear. A doctor comes to a small village in Santa Mira, California. Isn't it strange that they're all in California? But anyways, all the people around in the village are slowly becoming soulless. They're the same people. They're still very smart, but they have no souls anymore. And what we find out is that there's been an alien invasion, and this alien invasion incorporates pods. These pods create exact duplicates of human beings, but they strip away the soul. They strip away their humanity. All is left is the shell and the brain.
A moment's sleep, and the girl I loved was an inhuman enemy bent on my destruction. That moment's sleep was death to Becky's soul, just as it had been for Jack and Teddy and Dan Kaufman and all the rest. Their bodies were now hosts harboring an alien form of life, a cosmic form, which to survive must take over every human man. So I ran as little Jimmy Grimaldi had run the other day. My only hope was to get away from Santa Mira, to get to the highway, to warn the others of what was happening.
I'll just say, thank heavens the 50s are over. but the fear is clear.
That was obviously Kevin McCarthy doing a voiceover about what was happening near the end of the film.
Andrew O'Hare, I wonder that in The Matrix, it seems, that even when the humans are all bottled up in their pods, they do still have their souls. Once when they manage to break out, that, in fact, seems to be the antidote to the world of the computer, the Matrix.
Yeah, I think there is a real dialogue about the nature of the soul in the Matrix films. And essentially, they are optimistic in the sense that they believe that the dominance of the machines doesn't crush the human spirit or something. And it's interesting that you bring up the invasion of the Body Snatchers, which isn't really, I don't think, a film about technology. It was a film about communism and, you know, about the ideological warfare that people feared was going to destroy the human spirit at that point in history. I think it's not exactly analogous. But, yeah, in a funny way, the films about technology now are trying to maintain that sense that the essential human spirit isn't going to be crushed.
Well, the pieces can be kind of interchanged here sometimes. I mean, the fear of the soullessness of a machine age is a fear that can then transfer, as you say, Andrew, to fear of a political menace. I mean, it easily becomes a stew, doesn't it, Gary?
Well, it becomes a stew, and, you know, I do want to say that I actually had the chance to talk to Don Siegel once about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and he said it really wasn't about communism. It was about pods. It was about people who are getting lost in the society and loss in the bureaucracy. So he just said there are people who are just pods out there. That's where the idea came from. And go ahead.
Alexander Cohen.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in. Sorry, but I also very much love this film and The Body Snatchers. And one of the things I want to mention is, yeah, absolutely, he does talk about the fact that it's really about the culture industry itself, and which turns people into pods. And then it bereft them of their soul. And I think that if you look at the third version of the Matrix, if you want to call it third version, that film also winds up that way because it's such a huge, I hesitate to use the word, but monstrosity of capitalism in a sense. It's just absolutely 18,000 theaters everywhere all at once. And it's absolutely all about the culture industry. So they've sort of lost, you know, their soul in that sense, I think.
So the undergroundfilm.org guy says it's Hollywood itself, which is the Matrix. Is that it, Alex?
You could say that. Absolutely true. And if you go back to people like Horkheimer and Adorno of the critical theories of the 40s and 50s, they were also responding to this clearly about Hitler and a bunch of other things. But they focused on the fact there was a potential fascism and control that was going to take place in our society, and Hollywood became very much part of that.
Let's look at another film that keeps this chain going, a kind of technology, in this case drug technology, but still about humans trying to figure out their place and how it's working for them, and also expressing fear. Gary?
Well, the film was Altered States, so Ken Russell's film, scripted by Padishayevsky, 1980. And it's, again, an exploration of reality. And in this case, what we're doing is the reality is internal. It is during the 70s, there was the culture of taking drugs, doing sleep deprivation to try and find out an inner peace, an inner reality. In this film, William Hurt plays Eddie Jessup, who is on that exploration. And we're going to hear a clip here, which kind of brings us to a happy ending, sort of, and that is he's gone to the point where he's
taken drugs to sort of look into himself? Is that
to try and find his basic core within himself, the reality within himself, mm-hmm. that somehow is going to give him some sort of inner truth. And that's what we were looking for. We were looking for an inner truth in this movie. Ken Russell directed, so it's a little over the top, but he's now come back from a very, very dangerous spot, and he's talking to his wife, played by Blair Brown.
The final truth of all things is that there is no final truth. Truth is what's transitory. It's human life that is real. I don't want to frighten you, Emily, but what I'm trying to tell you is that that moment of terror is a real and living horror, living and growing within me now. And the only thing that keeps it from devouring me is you.
Why don't you just come back to us?
It's too late. I don't think I can get out of it anymore. I can't live with it. The pain is too great.
Fire, Eddie. You made it real. You can make it unreal. If you love me, Eddie. If you love me, Eddie, then fire!
Altered States, 1980. It's not easy searching for the truth out there. My goodness. Andrew O'Hare, if you love me, in The Matrix and in this film, in many of these films, it's that kind of bridge of the soul, of love, that's supposed to be the thing that keeps it together, that brings humans back to themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, clearly, one of the many cultural references in The Matrix movies is the epic romance and the story between Neo and Trinity, the character played by Carrie-Anne Moss, as peripheral as she seems to be by the end of the whole thing. It is supposed to be a grand cycle of love and death that in which they're asserting their humanity. It's very, very mythic in that sense. And I think that, it's almost impossible to do this kind of thing without touching on those particular cultural lodestones.
Love to try and pull something human through it, of course, it also an emotion that everyone in the theater can finally land on after these weird trips.
Exactly, and that's part of why we need to have that element within the story, because we're approaching our fears. We're not really, really feared, but we are trying to approach our fears, and to bring us back to a safe place, we have to know that there is a connection between everybody else, and that connection is love, and that you do have a mate someplace.
So, but love is also...
Alex, please.
Yeah, that love is also, throughout all of these films, I think, love is always considered to be the one thing that's not of the realm of the technological, that cannot be reproduced, it cannot be anything but something that's very, very human. There's a great Star Trek episode, for instance, I think it's called What Little Girls Are Made Of, where these machines have actually replicated Captain Kirk. And one of the key moment is this question of love, where an android wants to fall in love with Kirk, and at that point, of course... she destroys herself.
Can't be done. There's the human thing. We wonder. There'll probably be a film about that one day. We're talking tonight about man and machine, screen heroes, wrestling with the nature of reality, what humankind has wrought. Alexander Cohen is with us, Andrew O'Hare and Garen Daly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about humans and technology on the big screen, about screen heroes wrestling with the nature of reality and what humankind has wrought. We're joined tonight by Alexander Cohen from UC Berkeley, from Salon.com, by Andrew O'Hare, and by our own Garen Daly with me in the studio. The governor of California has been in a couple of films, or the governor-to-be. Is he governor now? I guess he is, Alex. Is he officially governor now, Schwarzenegger?
Not yet, no.
Oh, any day now. But the Terminator had his own fling with technology and alternate reality.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that one up because, you know, without this film, Arnold Schwarzenegger's career probably would have stalled out and he would not be California's governor-elect. But in 1980...
So where's reality? Where's fiction there?
Sometimes I think we are in a very strange place. But in 1984, James Cameron did direct The Terminator, which is a wonderful example of what we're talking about, of the technology run amok. And in this case, you have a Terminator from the future coming to present time to attack a poor young woman and kill her because she is going to be the mother of the future rebel leader against the machines. And the thing that made this groundbreaking was not only the technology used in making the film, but the fact that, you know, this was an unstoppable, unthinking, unfeeling technological machine, much like how we were feeling at that time, that technology was just running amok on us and we had absolutely no control. And in the scene with Michael Biehn telling the young Linda Hamilton that she is going to be the person who is going to be attacked by the Terminator, he makes it very plain and very blunt.
The 600 series had rubber skin. We spotted them easy. But these are new. They look human. Sweat, bad breath, everything. Very hard to spot.
Look, I am not stupid, you know. They cannot make things like that yet.
Not yet. Not for about 40 years.
Are you saying it's from the future?
One possible future.
Then you're from the future too, is that right?
Right.
Just let me go.
Listen and understand. That Terminator is out there. It can't be reasoned with. It doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear. And it absolutely will not stop, ever, until you are dead.
The Terminator, 1984, and it's out to get her. Andrew O'Hare, I wonder, what are the qualities of the characters that get put forward as the savior in this case, or in The Matrix, of course, with Keanu Reeves as Neo? Are there consistent personalities or characters that are offered up as the likely savior?
Well, that's a very touchy question, isn't it? Because whenever you start talking about the savior, you're entering into some difficult theological, philosophical terrain in our culture. So these characters are always going to get very closely examined. I think you're always talking about some kind of a representative of perfection in a way, and that's a very difficult thing to pull off. I mean, Linda Hamilton, who played that character in the Terminator films, was, of course, this marvelously constructed woman with a physique we'd hardly ever seen on a female performer on the screen before.
But presumably it's perfection of more than just a good shape, more than just a handsome face in Keanu Reeves. There's something in Keanu Reeves, has got this famous blandness. So is it a kind of blankness that makes the savior effective?
Maybe it has to sort of be in every person, yes. I noticed that most of the time we're not talking about people who were already big stars playing these roles. I mean, Keanu's a big star now. I don't know that he was so big.
And Alex, what do you think? Apart from love, that kind of bridge back to humanness, what character do you see coming up in the one who's supposed to be able to, I don't know, carry the torch, light the light against the dark of the downside of technology?
What do you mean, inside the Terminator or?
Well, in any of these movies, I mean, there's again and again we see one character who's picked out as kind of the spear tip to thrust back against technology. I wonder if you see a consistent character there.
Well, it's very true. There's always a character who, you know, understands or sees through the limitations of everyone else. For instance, in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's the main character who is the one who refuses to basically go to sleep and thus fall victim to the to this pod-like character. In almost every film, there's always one character like that, and that, of course, that person always represents, you know, the audience to some degree. It's the one person that with the main protagonist, which we always identify with. We want to be Keanu Reeves. We want to be all powerful. We want to be the one person who doesn't fall asleep, who doesn't succumb to the culture industry.
So a little bit of blandness helps everyone identify with that character or see themselves in that character.
Yes, that's right.
Possibly.
Yeah, I mean, I think you look at some of the great screen actors. They always had that ability to do very little with their face so you could read what was going into, what was going on with them. And that was an important element of the connection between a movie star and the audience. The other thing is that we should also talk that a lot of these films embody Campbell's journey's hero themes where, you know, the hero is summoned and the hero meets a test and he fails at the test and then the hero comes back and redeems himself and there's salvation at the end. These are really standard themes that you see in Star Wars. And a lot of people have been talking that the Matrix trilogy is the Star Wars of the turn of the century.
So something new here, Andrew O'Hara, or ancient stories played out with special effects?
Well, I think it's more the latter than the former. Excuse me. I think that generally speaking in the movies, you're talking about stories that have been told multiple times that are wearing new clothes. And I'm not opposed to that. I think that's part of why the form is so potent, that we essentially are recycling the myths, and that's what our culture does.
And yet, interesting that at this moment in time, the idea of things not being what they seem has seemed especially potent. It certainly floated this film in its three forms now through an awful lot of box office sales, Garen.
Yeah, I think that there is a desire out in our culture right now for some sort of answers. And I have a quote here from the Wachowskis talking about when they had the first idea of the Matrix. They said that we believe philosophy, religion, and mathematics all try to answer the question, which is reconciling our natural world with another world that is perceived by our intellect. And that's what they tried to do with the first one successfully and not so successfully in the successive films.
Well, and on they go. Garen, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure as always.
In New York, Andrew O'Hara, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Andrew O'Hara is arts and film editor for Salon.com. And in Berkeley, California, Alexander Cohen, lecturer at UC Berkeley in film studies and executive director of undergroundfilm.org. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
There's the exit.
On my mark, give me full power at 90 degrees to lower left starboard.
Full power. 90 degrees.
Now. Hold on, baby.
Dear woman, you can drive.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
60 years of Western nations excusing and accommodating the lack of freedom in the Middle East did nothing to make us safe, because in the long run, stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty.
Do you really need to be president, Dad?
I can do a lot for America.
CBS will not broadcast the Reagans on November 16th and 18th. This decision is based solely on our reaction to seeing the final film, not the controversy that erupted around a draft of the script.
I'm not saying that every single day of President Reagan's tenure was all candy and roses. All we're looking for here is an effort for it to be historically accurate.
The canonization of Ronald Reagan at the time that I was writing and publishing Dutch is nothing like what is become current today, and I really think it's getting to the point of ridiculousness.
White folks in the South who drive pickup trucks with Confederate flag decals on the back ought to be voting with us and not them.
Most poor Southern whites don't wear a Confederate flag, and you ought not try to stereotype that.
All right, let me tell you the last thing we need in the South is somebody like you coming down and telling us what we need to do.
I make no apologies for reaching out to poor white people.
You know, we Republicans have a wonderful team, and we believe in teamwork. Being part of that team will help Mississippi for the next 4 years.
Unless hiring picks up and layoffs ease, the share of income spent could decline, a development that would hamper the vigor of the expansion. The odds, however, do increasingly favor a revival in job creation.
With this act of Congress, no enemy or friend can doubt that America has the resources and the will to
to see this war through to victory.
The current plan is that if the security situation permits, to go from 4 divisions and 17 brigades in Iraq today to 3 divisions and 13 brigades U.S. next year.
The aircraft caught fire upon landing. The cause of the helicopter incident is unknown at this time. 6 persons were on board and all died as a result of the incident.
They chose the sacrifice of a soldier, the sacrifice they made for their country, for their loved ones, for their future.
And there's a week President Bush unveils his new Middle East policy, saying it is time for the entire region to embrace democracy. Controversy over the CBS miniseries The Reagans under fire. CBS has moved the program to Showtime. Democratic candidate Howard Dean ignites a firestorm with his comments on Confederate flags and poor whites in the South. The GOP wins key gubernatorial races in the South, including in Kentucky and Mississippi. Alan Greenspan's outlook on the U.S. economy improves. President Bush signs the $87 billion Iraq aid package into law. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld outlines new plans for troop rotation in Iraq. And a Chinook helicopter is shot down near Fallujah, killing 16 U.S. soldiers. Today, a Black Hawk helicopter is downed near Tikrit, killing 6. 3 other soldiers were also killed, bringing the total this week to 25. 149 U.S. soldiers have been killed since President Bush announced the end of major combat, and many more have been wounded. Jack Beatty, there's a week.
The worst week yet for the U.S. Soldiers in Iraq. And to me, the symbol of it all comes down to one detail. According to an Iraqi who saw the first helicopter, Sunday's helicopter, crash, a survivor scampered out of it, and his legs were on fire. And when I saw that, I was reminded of something I've said before on this program, something John Adams said. He said, "Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war." I think he must have been thinking of things like those burning legs.
And yet, you know, Jack, we hear it again and again from the troops who are there saying, "We are proud to be serving in this effort, and we will give it everything we've got."
And they are giving it everything they've got, including their lives.
Lots of numbers this week. Economic numbers, numbers on the budget front, numbers from the Bush administration, Jack.
Yes, all kinds of numbers. 50 million is one of them that stuck in my mind. It's the total of political contributions over a decade made by the companies that have contracts in Afghanistan and Iraq, made to both parties. 50 is another number that was in the news this week. Those are the 50 Midwestern power plants that now won't have to make $10 to $20 billion worth of investments in scrubbering equipment and can pretty much do what they want with the air.
This is the Bush administration dropping the lawsuits that were out there against those plants.
That's right. And I think we're going to hear some protests against that from New Hampshire senators, both Republicans, whose constituents are going to be breathing that air. And then, of course, the week ended with very good news for the president. It looks like the tax cuts are working for the economy as a whole, rebutting the Democratic argument that they were just giveaways to the rich, although they were heavily weighted toward the top 1%, but they clearly are taking hold.
And jobs coming back. You know, we talked with Howard Dean just earlier in the week, asked him about the very hot growth numbers that had come out just a day or two before we spoke with him. And he said, yeah, the economy may be growing, but where are the jobs? Well, by week's end, there were the jobs. They're coming.
They're coming. They won't be enough to create the 2 million we've lost or to negate that. But any
well, not
job
yet anyway.
Gained,
not yet anyway.
Not yet. But any job gained is good. And then there was another victory for Mr. Bush, especially for one of his constituency groups, in signing the partial birth abortion ban. This is the historic moment really for the anti-abortion side, because this is the first time that the right has been impinged on in that way by Congress. It'll have court challenges, but it was a very significant moment.
And President Bush just wading forward step by step, his speech yesterday, making the point again the United States is going to stay involved in the Middle East. It's going to see democracy through there, as enormous a challenge as that may be. He's not backing down from the ambition.
No, and he's actually launching some criticism to Saudi Arabia, which is about time, it seems to me.
About time, but what a huge agenda. And behind him, of course, Americans divided on whether or not it can even be accomplished, whether or not it's a proper target. But it's a high ideal, whatever the practicalities. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashby.